Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. This is part 5 of 12. And we just completed Narada's giving really fascinating, detailed description of Bhakti Yoga in Satyayuga, starting with the Ashtanga Yoga system, then leading to Pranayama, then leading to Mantra, then leading to deity worship, and many different parts to the bhakti process, but focusing on pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Said, this is just suited for you, what your mother has said. Perfect fit. And he gave him Madhuvan as his place to do this process. So Dhruva circumambulated him and off he went, ready to begin his little stint of bhakti yoga. That's where we left off. So now he's beginning the process. We'll hear how that commences. And Narada, being very intelligent, he knew that the father, King Uttanapada, was really a wreck, feeling really badly. One can only imagine how he felt. His son just went to the forest, and who knows if he's even alive. So Narada went back to the palace of Maharaj Uttanapada, and after Dhruva entered Madhuvan forest to execute devotional service, the great sage Narada thought it wise to go to the king to see how he was faring within the palace. When Narada approached the king received him properly, offering him due obeisances. After being seated comfortably, Narada began to speak. And a cultural comment is, even though he was in terrible distress and lamentation, he didn't neglect etiquette. He properly received Narada. So in this, embedded in this whole presentation at different steps, there's reflections or exercises. So this is a reflection one. Any action has stages, thinking, feeling, willing. So please consider, what are some character-based thoughts and feelings that would propel us to offer all respects to others despite our own troubled state of mind in a given situation? Now, we could take suggestions, but I think we'll just pause, reflect a little bit. Because the purpose behind this is to internalize the Bhagavatam's message. So the behavior is the etiquette part, but preceding the etiquette part, there's something. So character-based thoughts and feelings. Even you're someone really distressed, really difficult, you still observe cultural etiquettes. Okay, so now we're going to go to what Narada says to the king. What happened to what Narada says to the king? Text 64 is Narada speaking. My dear king, your face appears to be withered up, and you look like you have been thinking of something for a very long time. Why is that? Have you been hampered in following your path of religious rights, economic development, and sense gratification? As if he didn't know. The king replied, "Oh, best of the brahmanas, I am very much addicted to my wife, and I am so fallen that I have abandoned all merciful behavior, even to my son, who is only 5 years old. I have banished him and his mother, even though he is a great soul and a great devotee. My dear Brahmana, the face of my son was just like a lotus flower. I am thinking of his precarious condition. He is unprotected. And he might be very hungry. Not only might be. He might have lain down somewhere in the forest and the wolves might have attacked to eat his body. Alas, just see how I was conquered by my wife. There's the verse. Just imagine my cruelty. Out of love and affection, the boy was trying to get up on my lap, but I did not receive him, nor did I even pat him for a moment. Just imagine how hard-hearted I am. True confessions, but it's too late. As far as he knows, his son could be dead or something, hurt or miserable or who knows. Imagine how the king felt, any father would feel. So we heard, going way back, the react and respond. When one is overly attached, intelligence is taken away and one doesn't perform properly. So, some attachment is necessary. Over-attachment takes away intelligence. And one doesn't act properly. So now we're going to hear Narada pacifying the king, starting with text 68. Great sage Narada replied, "My dear king, please do not be aggrieved about your son. He is well protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Although you have no actual information of his influence, his reputation is already spread all over the world." That was fast. Now, this is the well protected is underlined because that's the theme. It's what his mother understood when she allowed her son. She didn't tell him go off to the forest, but she allowed him to go, 5-year-old boy, alone, into the forest. Not possible. We discussed this. Shadanagati. Question. So this is our commentators discussing this. How can one live in the forest and not be taken care of by anyone? Answer. Given by a great authority, Narada Muni, that such persons are well protected by the Supreme Lord. Sharanagati or surrender means acceptance or firm belief that wherever the surrendered soul lives, he is always protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yet never alone or unprotected. Anyone who engages in devotional service anywhere within this universe is never unprotected. So that was text 68. Here's text 69. My dear king, very soon your son Your son is very competent. He will perform activities which would be impossible, even for great kings and sages. Very soon, he will complete his task and come back home. You should know that he will also spread your reputation all over the world. The great Maitreya said, the king, Uttanapada, after being advised by Narada Muni, practically gave up all duties in relation to his kingdom, which was very vast and wide. It was the whole world, actually. Opulent, like the goddess of fortune, and he simply began to think of his son, Dhruva. And he was like that for 6 months. Because Dhruva came back after 6 months. Now back in Mahavan, Dhruva Maharaj, having arrived in, Madhuvan, took his bath in the river Jamuna and observed fasting in the night with great care and attention. And after that, as advised by the great sage Narada, he engaged himself in worshiping the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Looks pretty peaceful. Probably a little rougher than that picture. Then Prabhupada's purport to that verse, our only, I put in really big letters, only concern should be how to execute the order of the spiritual master. A spiritual master is expert in giving special instructions to each of his disciples, and if the disciple executes the order of the spiritual master, that is the way of his perfection. Now, Prabhupada was interested. He often used the word perfection, you know, path of perfection and so on. But the bhakti process is not just to get comfortable and, you know, better situated. It's the path to perfection. And the path to perfection is this very simple principle. It's expressed in so many ways. Mai chananya yogena bhaktira vyabhicharini, that item of knowledge is made possible by acharya upasana. This is 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Or another nice place in Bhagavad Gita, the 241 purport, Prabhupada says it twice. The secret to success in spiritual life is taking the instruction of the spiritual master as one's life and soul. Now Prabhupada, you know, didn't just say it, he did it. That was his success. He took a very difficult instruction as his life and soul. And he achieved perfection. Although he felt the instruction was impossible. With those many nice expressions of Prabhupada saying, I was horrified. I don't think he was just tongue-in-cheek saying that to, like, pat us on the head or something. You may also feel horrified. But whatever he was feeling, the spiritual master's instruction. So that's what Dhruva did. Now, he began the process of devotional service, but it included some austerities, as you know. And we're going to hear about those austerities next, starting with text 72. Really intense. We don't need to worry about imitating Dhruva's austerities. For the first month, Dhruva ate only fruits and berries on every third day, only to keep his body and soul together. And in this way, he progressed in his worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That was the first month. In the second month, Dhruva ate only every 6 days. And for his eatables, he took only yummy dry leaves and grass. Doesn't say yummy. Thus, he continued his worship. Of course, he offered them to Krishna first. In the third month, he drank water only every 9 days. 5-year-old boy, right? Thus, he remained completely in trance and worshiped the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is adored by selected verses. Where do you go from there? In the 4th month, Dhruva became a complete master of the breathing exercise, and thus he inhaled air only every 12th day. In this way, he became completely fixed in his position and worshiped the Supreme Personality of Godhead, of course, all the while chanting his mantra. By the 5th month, Maharaj Dhruva, son of the king, had controlled his breathing so perfectly that he was able to stand only on one leg, just as a column stands without motion, and concentrate his mind fully on the Parabrahman. Text 77, the last of the section. He completely controlled his senses and their objects. And in this way, he fixed his mind without diversion to anything else upon the form of the Supreme Personality of God. If you remember, that form was described very, very beautifully. Oh, that was yesterday evening. Really nice description. And Narada also mentioned the pastimes of other forms of the Lord. I mean, Narada, only 5 years old, his grandfather is Swayambhuvamanu, and his great-grandfather is Brahma, so he knew lots of things about the personality of Godhead, and he is fixed. So now comes the effects of his meditation. Notice the crack in the ground, and everything seems to be trembling. When Dhruva Maharaj thus captured the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the refuge of the total material creation, and who is the master of all living entities, the 3 worlds began to tremble. Cha kampyute, trayo lokas cha kampyute. And this word I put in color-coded. Dhara yamanasya. Dhara yamanasya. In the word for word, the translation is captured, and the word for word is taken into the heart. Now, the super soul is already in the heart, but he was fixed in consciousness of, or he captured, or he had taken into, so he couldn't get away, and the Lord couldn't get away. He was fixed. He was in trance. Samadhi. 5-year-old Samadhi boy. Amazing. So the question is raised by our acharyas, how is it possible for Dhruva Maharaj to capture Brahman within his heart? Jiva Goswami says, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the origin of Brahman, for since he, Personality of Godhead, comprises everything material and spiritual, there cannot be anything greater than he. In other words, to capture the Brahman, it's all-pervasive. How do you capture Brahman? Well, you capture the all-pervasive Brahman because it emanates from the person. Many persons, especially the Mayavadi philosophers, consider Brahman the biggest, all-expanding substance. But according to this verse and other Vedic literature such as Bhagavad Gita, you can tell this is Prabhupada's language, the resting place of Brahman is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, just as the resting place of sunshine is the sun globe. Srila Jiva Goswami therefore says that since the transcendental form of the Lord is the seat of all greatness, he is the Supreme Brahman. Since the Supreme Brahman was situated in the heart of Dhruva Maharaj, he became heavier than the heaviest. and therefore everything trembled in all the three worlds and in the spiritual world. Pretty intense. The material world trembling, that's one thing. The spiritual world trembling, that's another thing. Then Prabhupada explains the three Brahman Paramatma Bhagavan features. Bhagavan is the resting of the other two. By constantly associating, with a supreme personality in his heart, Dhruva Maharaj naturally became equal to the greatest Brahman by his association, and thus became the heaviest, and the entire universe trembled. Then there's a metaphor of how the universe was trembling. As Dhruva Maharaj, the king's son, kept himself steadily standing on one leg, the pressure of his big toe pushed down half the earth, just as an elephant being carried on a boat rocks the boat left and right with every step. Now, compliments to the graphic person that found this image. That's really a good image. A little tiny boat and a big elephant. Just a little anecdotal story. In Mayapur, there's an elephant. Name is Gulab. I don't know if there's some connection between Gulab and Globjimin, but his name is Gulab. And on certain festival days, they take Gulab onto a boat. And when Gulab steps on the boat, so the devotees by now, they know, you know, how to be on the other side of the boat. And then when he moves over, steps the other foot, they have to run over to the other side of the boat. It seemed like, you know, why put the elephant in a boat to begin with? Pretty scary. But the elephant, too, supposing he falls in the swift river going by. Anyway, they know what they're doing, I guess. And Dhruva's being very heavy had to do with his, like, demonstrating his having captured the Lord within his heart. So now, when Dhruva Maharaj was at home, this is commentary, although he was a king's son, he was prevented from getting on the lap of his father. But when he became advanced in self-realization or devotional service, by the pressure of his toe, he could push down the whole earth. That is the difference between ordinary consciousness and Krishna consciousness. In ordinary consciousness, a king's son may be refused something even by his father, but when the same person becomes fully Krishna conscious within his heart, he can push down the earth with the pressure of his toe. That's a detail, but I like this detail, so I'm sharing it. The word that's used, how far he pressed the earth down, the word that's used is pradesha. Pradesha. And it has different meanings in different places. But Vishwanath says it means a half a pradesha is how far he pressed it down, which is half of 5 inches, which makes more sense than he just pressed the whole earth down. So, and Srila Prabhupada's writing, he generally uses 6 inches as a one pradesha, or sometimes 8 inches, but whatever it is, the earth was pressed down a little bit by his toe, big toe. Further commentary, when Dhruva Maharaj became practically one in heaviness with Lord Vishnu, well, this is the verse, the total consciousness, or Vishvam Atmanaha, total consciousness, due to his fully concentrating and closing the holes of his body, the total universal breathing became choked up, and all the great demigods and all the planetary systems felt suffocated and thus took shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, a question that came to me, and it may be coming to you too, what about other yogis during Satya Yoga that knew how to do this process, and they controlled their breathing, you know, why the universe didn't get choked up then too? So if you have that question, don't ask me, because I don't know. But the verse speaks of Vishnu. Vishnu is understood in various ways, sometimes the all-pervading Vishnu. Of course, he has a form, but that form, as by his expansion, as Paramatma, is everywhere. And by his energies, he's everywhere. So he's everywhere. He's all-pervasive. But another is total consciousness, Vishvam Atmanaha. You know, total consciousness. Like a phrase during my college days was cosmic consciousness. People didn't know what that meant, but they used it. Cosmic consciousness. You could hear sometimes Prabhupada was asked, you know, when you chant this mantra, can you reach cosmic consciousness? And Prabhupada asked, what's that? And, you know, well, they said something you couldn't hear. It wasn't so audible. And he kind of dismissed it. But Vishnu isn't something you dismiss. The total consciousness is he's conscious of everything, everywhere, at all times. That's quite inconceivable. That's the total consciousness of Vishnu. And he became one in heaviness with him due to his full concentration. So abhidhyayati and atmanya dia, these two phrases are used in the verse. Dia, meditation. At, ananyaya, undivided concentration. And abhi, dhyayati. So he was going for perfection. He wasn't, you know, fiddling. He wasn't distracted. We're distracted. We're trying, but we're distracted. But he somehow managed to become completely fixed. So there's this nice painting, BBT painting. Dhruva's over there on the left doing what he's doing. And over on the right, there's the demigods who are suffocating. And of course, they go to Lord Vishnu. The explanation that Prabhupada gives, this example of Dhruva Maharaj is closing the holes of his personal body and thereby closing the breathing holes of the total universe clearly indicates that a devotee, by his personal devotional service, can influence all the people of the whole world to become devotees of the Lord. That's a nice photograph. Prabhupada somehow looks pretty luminous. Maybe it's photoshopped a little bit. But it's still nice. And what Dhruva did is not what Prabhupada did. He didn't block the holes of his body. He became fully Krishna conscious. He became empowered by Krishna to carry Krishna's message forward. And by his influence, so many people, it's possible, the influence is there for the whole world to become devotees of Krishna. And thus, if there's only one pure devotee in pure Krishna consciousness, he can change the total consciousness of the world into Krishna consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada made a startling effect on the world, one man. Very powerful. So now comes the section where the demigods are taking shelter of the personality of Godhead. Nice painting. That's Lord Brahma with four heads sitting there. Other demigods surrounding him, Lord Shiva in the background. And then behind him, of course, is Mahavishnu. Excuse me, Shiradakshe Vishnu reclining on Anantashesh. And another similar picture. The demigods said, they went to the shore of the Milk Ocean. Dear Lord, you are the refuge of all moving and non-moving living entities. We feel all living entities to be suffocating, their breathing process choked up. We have never experienced such a thing. Since you are the ultimate shelter of all surrendered souls, we have therefore approached you. Kindly save us from this danger. They're interested in their own well-being, but they're also interested, because they're demigods, in the well-being of everyone. And it's a very difficult, unprecedented event. They don't know what to do. Prabhupada's purport. The Supreme Lord is the ultimate goal for the solution of all to all problems within this material world. In the spiritual world, there are no problems. Well, there's no material problems. But the material world is always problematic. Vishvam Purnam Sukhayate. He quotes Chaitanya Chandramrita. That's Prabodhananda Saraswati's writing. It's really nice. Vishvam Purnam Sukhayate. Devotees are free from all problems because they are fully surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For a devotee, everything in the world is very pleasing because he knows how to use everything in transcendental loving service of the Lord. So in other words, even when there's a difficulty, one knows how to negotiate or navigate their way through. Vishvam Purnam Sukhayate. The Supreme Personality of Godhead replied, "My dear demigods, do not be perturbed by this. It is due to the severe austerity and full determination of the son of King Uttanapada, who is now fully absorbed in thought of me. He has instructed the universal breathing process. You can safely return to your respective homes. I shall stop this boy in his severe acts of austerities, and you will be saved from this situation. He has simply concentrated his mind on me. This will not destroy anything." That's commentary. So the pastime is so celebrated. There's many, many, many nice paintings of Vishnu coming before Dhruva. So we'll see several of them. That's the end of the chapter. And we're going to just cover the beginning part of chapter 9. 5 verses. How are we doing with time? What time is it? Okay. So this is, the Lord makes his appearance. He touches Dhruva with his conch, and Dhruva is now ready to offer his prayers. So the chapter begins this way. The great sage Maitreya told Vidura, "When the demigods were thus reassured by the personality of Godhead, they were freed from all fears, and after offering their obeisances, they returned to their heavenly planets. Then the Lord, who is non-different from Sahasra Shirsha incarnation," who's that? The Sahasra Shirsha incarnation, we'll find out shortly. He's non-different from Sahasra Shirsha. "He got on the back of Garuda, who carried him to Madhavan forest to see his servant Dhruva." This is the phrase Madhavan, Madhor Vanam, Britya Didrikshaya Gata. By means of Garuda, the Lord went to Madhavan with the desire to see his servant Dhruva. So there's Garuda looking this way. Lord Vishnu has more arms in this picture than he does in this picture. And Garuda is carrying a snake just in case he gets hungry. Here's Prabhupada's purport. According to Sanatana Goswami, in his Brihat Bhagavatamrita, the Sahasra Shirsha personality of Godhead, who appeared at that time, was the incarnation known as Prishnigarbha. We heard that before, right? Prishnigarbha. the same as the son of Suttapa and Prishi, the same form of Vishnu that appeared as their son, appeared in this way. He provided the planet known as Dhruvaloka for the habitation of Dhruva Maharaj. And then here's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur commenting. It is understood from Laghu Bhagavatamrita that the avatar who appeared in front of Dhruva was Prishnigarbha. He is called Sahasrashirsha, which refers to Garbhodakshai Vishnu because they are not different, both being Vishnu. Got it? Vishnu in the milk ocean is Shiradakshai Vishnu. But Shiradakshai Vishnu and Garbhodakshai Vishnu, they're actually non-different. Technically, Sahasrashirsha refers to Garbhodakshai Vishnu. But it can also refer to the Supersoul because his hands and legs are everywhere. Sahasrashirsha, Purusha, Sahasraksha, Sahasrapada, etc. The terminology, something that I've learned about that this terminology is, don't get compulsive about if it's this, it can't be that. Because you have whiplash if you do that one. Because just this morning, I was looking through Laghu Bhagavatamrita for something else, and I came across the name of the form of Vishnu who resides in the milk ocean is Ajita, not Prishnigarbha. Prishnigarbha is the name of that form that appeared in this world. Ajita is the name of the Lord that's in the spiritual world in Svetadvipa. But he's not different than Garbhodakshai Vishnu, who's Sahasrashirsha. So if you're really puzzled, that's okay. The nomenclature is just identifying a particular aspect or feature of the same Supreme Lord. So if you like this one, that's good. If you like that one, that's good. They do refer to different features or aspects of him and his services and his activities. So don't worry about the nomenclature if you get confused. The form of the Lord, which is, this is the next verse, text 2. The form of the Lord, which was brilliant like lightning, and in which Dhruva Maharaj, in his mature yogic process, was fully absorbed in meditation, all of a sudden disappeared. Thus, Dhruva was perturbed, and his meditation broke. But as soon as he opened his eyes, he saw the Supreme Personality Godhead personally present, just as he had been seeing the Lord in his heart. Now here's a little sweetness to all of this, and I'll just paraphrase it before you see the slide. It's one of our acharyas speaking about how elevated are the Vrijvasis. The Vrijvasis, when they were separated from Krishna, their intensity of meditation upon Krishna was such as they could see him in front of him, although they're simultaneously feeling separation from him. Go down a notch or two, and there's Dhruva, and he's seeing the Lord within his heart. But then suddenly, for the purpose of this assistance of the demigods, as well as showing his favor to Dhruva, that Lord in the heart disappears and he sees the Lord outside. The acharyas are saying the residents of Vrindavan go even beyond Dhruva's status. The intensity of their loving devotion. So here's the commentary. In their trance of separation, the devotees of Braja are aware of nothing but Krishna. Their ecstasy is so deep that as a natural effect of remembering Krishna, they see him physically before them. Only pure devotees whose love for Krishna is not on the same level of perfection have separate experiences of him internally and externally. Dhruva, for example, concentrated his mind on Lord Vishnu in deep meditation, but his internal vision of the Lord did not expand into a vision outside, like that of the gopis. Only when Lord Vishnu came to Dhruva to offer him special mercy did the Lord disappear from Dhruva's heart to show himself externally. So, the gopis are the best. It's a nice one to remember, Keshu. You're in a trance of meditation on how wonderful are the gopis. It's a nice one to meditate on. Prabhupada. In the Brahma Samhita 538, it says, Premanjuna Charita Bhakti Vilochanena, a saintly person. Who is that saintly person pictured here? Vilvamangala, right? And there's Krishna. He's blind, but he's seeing Krishna. A saintly person who has developed love of Godhead by devotional service always sees the Lord's transcendental form of Shyamasundara, the Shyamasundara form of the Lord within his heart. Within the heart of a devotee is not imaginary. And further in the purport, when a devotee becomes mature in his prosecution of devotional service, he sees face to face the same Shyamasundara he has thought of during the entire course of his devotional service. When, oh, when will that day be mine, right? But it starts somewhere. So here's another reflection. And the reflection is, like Dhruva, we should also, with faith, persevere and remain within the bhakti process given to us by our acharyas, by Prabhupada and our teachers. And we just stay with that and Krishna will come to us and stay with us. Isn't that nice? That's the lesson. You know, Bhaktisiddhanta's phrase, don't try to see Krishna, act in a way Krishna will see you or want to see you. Like that. It sounds like a bird. It's a plane. It's a super baby. Okay. Excuse me. When Dhruva Maharaj saw his Lord just in front of him, he was greatly agitated and offered him obeisances and respect. He fell flat before him like a rod and became absorbed in love of Godhead. Dhruva Maharaj, in ecstasy, looked upon the Lord as if he were drinking the Lord with his eyes, kissing the lotus feet of the Lord with his mouth and embracing the Lord with his arms. We didn't do all those things, but that was the ecstasy with which he was looking upon the Lord. His heart was in a wonderful turmoil, a great ecstasy of turmoil of embracing the Lord and so on. One of the many, many nice paintings of the same appearance of the Lord before Dhruva. Here he's sitting, here he's reaching. Nice painting. All these features of Dhruva Maharaj's bodily expression indicate that upon seeing the Lord face to face, he developed the eight kinds of transcendental ecstasy in his body. Two more verses. Although Dhruva Maharaj was a small boy, he wanted to offer prayers to the Supreme Personality of Godhead in suitable language, but because he was inexperienced, he could not adjust himself immediately. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, being situated in everyone's heart, could understand Dhruva Maharaj's awkward position. Out of his causeless mercy, he touched his conch shell to the forehead of Dhruva Maharaj, who stood before him with folded hands. Celebrated gesture. Many paintings have that specific gesture also. He already had the hand of Narada touch his head, and now he has the conch of the Supreme Lord touch his head. Phew. Prabhupada writes, the personality of Godhead being situated in everyone's heart specifically gives a devotee intelligence to describe him. It is therefore understood that when a devotee writes or speaks about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his words are dictated by the Lord from within. Isn't that a nice illustration of that purport? This is Prabhupada doing the Bhaktivedanta purports, and his consciousness is being dictated by Krishna. As he said, these were not written by me, these were written by the Personality of Godhead. Just hearing his own purports, Prabhupada was on another plane of existence, definitely. When Dhruva Maharaj felt hesitant, not knowing how to describe the Lord for want of sufficient experience, the Lord, out of his causeless mercy, touched his conch shell to Dhruva's forehead, and he was transcendentally inspired. The transcendental inspiration is called Brahma Maya, because when one is thus inspired, the sound he produces exactly corresponds to the sound vibration of the Vedas. This is not the ordinary sound vibration of this material world. Therefore, the sound vibration of the Hare Krishna mantra, although presented in the ordinary alphabet, should not be taken as mundane or material. Very nice. And concluding, there's this reference from Hari Bhakti Sodadaya, Swamin Katarto Smivaram Niyache. Invariably, Prabhupada would quote this. It's not from Bhagavatam. It's from Hari Bhakti Sodadaya, but it's a very celebrated part of the message that we hear when we hear Prabhupada describe the Dhruva story. Paraphrased, oh my Lord, because I was seeking an opulent material position, I was performing severe types of penance and austerity. Now I have gotten you, who is very difficult for the great demigods, saintly persons, and kings to attain. I was searching after a piece of glass, but instead I have found a most valuable jewel. Therefore, I am so satisfied that I do not wish to ask any benediction from you. Now, Prabhupada would tell this phrase and this message as if it was from the Bhagavatam, but that's okay. It's certainly connected. These are the words of Dhruva, Jiva Goswami's commentary. They do not spring from full realization of the sweet aspect of the Lord. These words arose from the touch of the Lord's conch. However, it is evident that gradually he obtained that realization. Interesting, huh? Our acharyas like to emphasize the sweetness aspect. There's the opulence aspect, and there's the sweetness aspect, and they really like to emphasize the sweetness aspect. It nourishes our appreciation for the sweetness aspect. At that time, last verse, Dhruva Maharaj became perfectly aware of the Vedic conclusion and understood the absolute truth and his relationship with all living entities. In accordance with the line of devotional service to the Supreme Lord, whose fame is widespread, Dhruva, who in the future would receive a planet which would never be annihilated, even during the time of dissolution, offered his deliberate and conclusive prayers. That's tomorrow. His prayers begin. And next to the last, Dhruva Maharaj never went to any school or academic teacher to learn Vedic conclusion. But because of his devotional service to the Lord, as soon as the Lord appeared and touched his forehead with his conch shell, automatically the entire Vedic conclusion was revealed to him. So if you don't want to go to school, you just do what Dhruva did. You get a lot of mercy and you got your diploma. But otherwise you should go to school and study the wonderful words just for the sake of the sweetness of them. The Vedas indicate that the only that only the one who has unflinching faith in the Supreme Lord as well as the spiritual master is the Vedic conclusion revealed. That's natural commentary by Prabhupada because it's something he quoted regularly. Yasya devi para bhaktir yata deve tata garau tasya te katita hyarta prakashante mahatmanaha. Okay, so now we're ready for Dhruva's prayers. And it only took 1 hour to do all this. So we have a little bit of time for discussion. Looking around the room, I'm sure there's going to be some discussion. Yes.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. When we were hearing about when Dhruva Maharaj was practicing his meditation,
yeah,
his level of tapasya was increasing month by month.
Yeah.
And he was alone, so it's not like Narada was telling him, okay, now you take it to this next level or something. So my question is, in our own lives, when we also, obviously we don't take tapasya to that extent, but we do some tapasya in order to, you know, practice our sadhana.
Yes.
So can you provide some pointers on how can we know when we can take our tapasya
to a next level? Well, I have a few thoughts on this. Something that Shatrupa asked the other day is, sometimes we find, she was discussing with a friend of hers, that our activities become somewhat routine. Not mechanical, wasn't the word, but routine, and time gets taken up in doing routine. And so I was thinking some more about that, which is a little bit related to your question. Not directly, but somewhat. The essence of the benefit of tapasya is to awaken spontaneity. You know, it's control the mind and senses for the purpose of getting the incubation chamber for bhakti to grow, but really it's what's wanted is the bhakti is to grow. So that the essence is not the austerities and penances, that those are supportive of the incubation chamber for bhakti to grow. So what we really want is bhakti. So now, back to your question, it's that which is going to help your bhakti grow. You know, so what are some of the rules of thumb or guidelines? Simply expressed is when there's Ekadasis, when there's appearance days of the Lord or great Vaishnavas, or when there's special times like the Purushottam month or Kartik month, then it's right in nectar devotion, something. And then it makes them increase according to those auspicious days. And then there's a beginning and an end. And then one at the end of some auspicious something, one may decide, you know, I think I can increase or my reading, or I can increase my chanting, or I can and diminish. So you do it in increments. My rule of thumb advice is do in increments, in that using that as a entryway. Auspicious times, do something. And even just doing something for a whole month, that takes some control of the mind. And that's good. That's tapasya. Because mind not controlled, forget it, for spiritual progress. So just to do something for a month. But it's not just to do the something. Again, it's for the purpose of increasing bhakti, nourishing bhakti. And letting go of something. I have this really, really vivid memory of Tamal Krishnamurti teaching nectar devotion in the VIHE at the same time I was teaching something, and Raghunath, Dandadhar Swami's disciple Raghunath, was sharing, he had just heard, this class, and he took it seriously when Tamal Krishnamurti was saying they should think of something that's very dear to them and give it away to someone else. Detachment. So, and for him, I think it was a really warm sleeping bag, because at Kartik time it's really cold, and or maybe it was a jacket or sleeping bag, something like that. And he gave it up, and it was like, oh. But he felt, you know, after having done it and after having gone through the whiplash of having, you know, given it up, can't ask for it back, he actually felt lighter. So that's another, you know, just take an instruction that's there in Rupa Goswami and you fulfill it because it's an instruction of Rupa Goswami, which is similar to taking the instruction as one's life and soul. You follow it because it's an instruction to do so. You know, and specifically, Tamal was saying something that's important to you, not something that's unimportant to you, something that's important to you. You know, not so that you bleed, but, you know, and you sacrifice for others. That's good. So another rule of thumb is sustainable. Unsustainable vratas make you feel bad. Oh, I'm a loser. And something, that negative emotion thing. So something sustainable, and then have a little celebration, and then think, okay, what's next? Like that, and use the parameters of auspicious days or auspicious periods. And it gives strength. Anything else?
Maharaj, I was just wondering, when exactly did Dhruva Maharaj's material desires fall off? When he left home, he had them. When he went to, when he met Narada, he said he couldn't follow all of his instructions because his material desires were so overwhelming, if I remember right. Then
yes.
When he went to Madhuvan, he still had those material desires.
Yes, he did.
Then he went into, and he did such intense austerities.
I got the question. The question is, how did it wasn't at
when
once.
When and how?
The how was bhakti. And it wasn't at once, it was gradual. You know, the darkness got replaced by light.
Mm-hmm.
So effort and mercy combined. So the effort was being made and the mercy was being extended corresponding to the effort being made, the desire diminished. Bhaktisiddhanta uses the word effaced.
Mm.
You know the meaning? The example of effacing is like coins, when they're minted, they're very clear picture of the date and the face and the whatever it says.
Mm.
And after some time rubbing and rubbing and rubbing with other coins, it gets effaced. You can't see the date or the name or the face anymore. Mm. Effaced. Just by rubbing. So, the bhakti process has the effect of effacing contamination. Chanting, he uses it in connection with chanting. Even namabhas chanting steadily done has an effacing effect.
Mm.
But the effacing effect is perceivable by the awakening of a stronger desire on the bhakti side than just the abhas chanting to go beyond. The desire to go beyond abhas chanting get stronger. That's a sign that the effacing is taking place. So that is the covering is being diminished and the bhakti is being increased. So your question is, at what point in time it fell off? It didn't fall off. It was gradually diminished as his bhakti was gradually increasing. Because the austerities was, you know, just a, I'm using this word, incubation chamber. It was an assisting factor. But the essence was the bhakti, the meditation upon the form of the Lord. There had this detailed description of a deity form of the Lord. We don't hear anything of Dhruva with a deity form, but meditation on the form, mantra, pastimes, bhakti. This bhakti was being nourished in this chamber of sense control. And the material, the desire to get the kingdom gradually subsided. The get-back mentality gradually subsided. It's gradual. That's the answer.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. And same for us. Gradual. Anyone else in the room?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. The performing the austerity itself, its austerities itself is not wrong, but the intention for which the austerities is performed is, I mean, it is going to be a challenge. That's what my understanding is.
Well, it's neither wrong, right nor wrong. It's not only not wrong, it's not neither right nor wrong. It's important. What Prabhupada would say, minimal is the four regular principles. That's austerity. For people of this world, that's austerity. Oh, impossible. Right? Impossible. So, and it's not only possible, it's an austerity to follow the principles and then further austerities.
So I was thinking, Dhruva Maharaj performing the austerities, because the intention was initially to get back mentality. Is that
could have been what?
To get back, I mean, to...
No, he wasn't doing the austerities to get back. He was doing the whole program to get what he wanted, which was get back. In other words, when he's sitting there, you know, he's eating roots and berries every 3 days. He's not, I mean, or water every 9 days or whatever the sequence was. I'm doing this because I want to get back. He's doing it because he wants to get Vishnu, and the wants to get Vishnu is because he wants to get back. So it's mixed. It's sakam bhakti. But bhakti. If it just stays sakam, then the bhakti doesn't grow. He wanted Vishnu. And he had and he wanted to fulfill the, Narada's kindness, reciprocate with Narada's kindness. Both are bhakti principles. Is that all right?
Yeah, and the reason I was asking that question, Maharaj,
The reason?
When Prabhupada mentions a lot of times performing the austerities for material purposes is going to be a problem for the society.
Problem for the society?
Society, yeah. I mean, like, for example, fasting for a political reasons or... Right?
Could you say... I don't get the whole picture of what you're trying to communicate. Give the bigger picture.
Here, there are a lot of challenges because of Dhruva Maharaj's austerities.
Yes.
So, Prabhupada comments elsewhere, and I think Bhagavad Gita performing not eating for political reasons. A lot of politicians does it, fasting.
Yes, for yes, many days. Yes.
I mean,
yes.
It is not good for the society, I mean, in a sense.
Well, it's not good for themselves either.
Yeah. So is that the reason that because I was thinking that Dhruva Maharaj was doing that austerities for a specific purpose, which is not right. To start with, maybe later on it is a bhakti process. Is that the reason that is having a lot of challenges?
No, I'm not sure what you're asking, but it's more common that people do austerities for material purposes then people do austerities for spiritual purposes. It's very common that people do austerities for material purposes. Even non-Vedic austerities. I mean, you know, highly successful people are really austere people. From what I read, Osama bin Laden was a very austere guy. No, he was a tapasvi to get shakti so he could do bad things. You know, little Hiranyakashipu. And so forth, without going into, you know, anecdotal things. So it's very common. So austerities for material purposes is not good for the person, because if they don't have a spiritual purpose, they're gonna, whatever shakti comes to them from that austerity, they'll use in a bad way. Duskriti. But there's nothing good and bad about the austerity in itself. It's the consciousness behind it. I think that's your point.
Yeah, so that impacts the society in general as well, because that's
okay. Yeah. That's what you mean? That's what you mean? Oh, I didn't get what that's what you mean. Well, you know, there was a temporary inconvenience for everybody, but look at the result. Because it was for Vishnu, you know, look at the result. He became a pure devotee and walking around the planet for as long as he was around the planet, he was good for the planet. And good for the universe. You know, that was one of the messages here. So it's the consciousness behind. Okay. Let's do some online discussion, because they'll feel neglected, our online people. We get feedback, they feel neglected.
Sri Radhika Mataji has three questions. The first question is, you said that Sharanagati means acceptance of firm belief that wherever the surrendered soul lives, he is always protected by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When Mother Suniti sent her 5-year-old son to the forest, he was not a fully surrendered soul. So what was her faith that her son will be protected based upon her own devotion to the Lord, which would render him favorable to her kith and kin?
I was distracted. So what's the, just say the punchline of the question again. And therefore what?
So when Mother Suniti sent Dhruva to the forest, he was not a surrendered soul.
Why is she saying that?
Dhruva was a mixed person, not...
Oh, but she was fully surrendered. She was praying to, it says, she was praying to Vishnu, please protect my son. Dhruva was protected by her.
That was the question.
Okay.
Second question is, there is nothing material about Narada Muni, yet his action of approaching King Uttanapada as if he did not know the situation could, in ordinary life, be seen as duplicity.
Oh, it's just courtesy. He says, he's not saying, I know your mind. You know, it's just being socially courteous. That's my understanding.
Third question is...
And giving the king a chance to pour his heart out. I mean, I had a meeting with somebody a while ago, and they wanted to pour their heart out. And I pretty much had an idea what they were, you know, what it was going to be. And I could have said, you know, let me do a quick one. Save yourself and myself some time. Here's what's in your heart. But, you know, that wouldn't have been nice. I let them pour their heart out. So they felt heard and all that. That's, you know, it's a social respect.
The next question is, we know that when Dhruva Maharaj returned, even Suruchi went to receive him. Is there any information regarding whether she had a change of heart And if so, what was the stimulus?
Well, some kind of change of heart, yes. She probably felt guilty. Maybe she didn't, but she probably felt guilty. And she probably felt that, you know, because it wasn't just her change of heart. She's in the presence now of a perfected soul. You feel something when you're in the presence of a perfected soul. You have to. So we don't know exactly what transformation went on within her, but something, and how it happened and the degree to which it happened, and we don't know. That's it. More. Go ahead.
This is from Snehavalli Mataji. It was said in the purport that when Dhruva Maharaj was touched by the conch shell, he attained all the realization. When Lord Vishnu appeared, Maharaj Dhruva was in a purified stage.
Yes.
So in that stage, he must have attained all knowledge. Did he not attain all realization through the bhakti process?
Well, part of the bhakti process was fulfilled when he was touched by the conch shell. I mean, what it says specifically, he was a little boy. He hadn't been to school. You know, he hadn't been formal education, five-year-old boy. What does he know? And how can he speak properly in this awesome situation like this? He was bewildered. He was confused. Whatever, that's not the word that was used. But his countenance was made complete. So if her question specifically was, did he have all Vedic knowledge before the conch shell or only after the conch shell? That seems to be what she's asking. It's made complete. I mean, and it's part of the culmination of the bhakti process, the favor of Lord Vishnu manifesting in that particular way. So it could happen some other way with another person, but it happened that way with Dhruva. And then that, and thus he knew he had the empowerment to speak in the way that he spoke his prayers. Next.
Mahati Kirti Mataji has two questions. The first question is, Dhruva Maharaj got purified when he saw the Lord and did not want anything material. But whereas Hiranyakashipu, after long penance, when Lord Brahma appeared, his material desire did not go away. I would like to hear your comments. Why purification did not happen when Hiranyakashipu saw Lord Brahma?
Because he didn't have bhakti, and Dhruva had bhakti.
The second question is, although Prahlad Maharaj did not see Lord Krishna directly, did he have intense desire to see the Lord directly, or was he satisfied with the realization of the Lord? Whenever he was put in danger, he prayed to the Lord for help. Lord never appeared directly. I'm curious to know, was his desire increased to see the Lord?
This is now Prahlad or Dhruva?
Prahlad Maharaj.
Prahlad. Well, this question was asked the other day. What was Prahlad seeing? When he said, where is your Lord? He's everywhere. What was he seeing? Remember that discussion? Was that with this group here? No, it was another evening. To say that he's everywhere was that he saw, you know, Lord Nrisimhadev everywhere, or he saw Vishnu everywhere, or he saw, what was it that he saw? And I don't know what he saw. At least he had knowledge from Narada that he had full faith in. At least he saw through the eye of knowledge. That much, for sure. The Supreme Lord is everywhere. including in the pillar and everywhere. So did he have a desire to see that form of the Lord? Naturally, a devotee wants to see the form of the Lord, but whether that was the prominent thing, he wanted to be in service to the Lord. That's the prominent thing. So it's an interesting question, but we don't have, you know, to what degree was he desiring to see the Lord, or was he just content in his devotion to the Lord? We don't have that indication.
The third question from Mahati Kirti Mataji, unrelated. Narada Muni and Parikshit Maharaj both saw Paramatma feature of Krishna. Did Narada Muni understand Bhagavan feature just by knowing Paramatma feature? And did Parikshit Maharaj forget the Lord's form he saw when he was in his mother's womb? And he had to hear Srimad Bhagavatam to understand about the Lord?
This is a complicated question. And the short answer is, according to one's devotion to the Lord, that's what the Lord will reveal. Now there's in the preamble is, he saw Paramatma. Now, I don't know if he saw Paramatma or if he saw Bhagavan. But one will see, according to the personality of Godhead are revealed to each person according to their faith and their regard for him. So that much you should be happy with understanding.
This is from Sachi Sutta Prabhu. The transformation and realization of Uttanapada regarding his attachment to his wife happened because of the association with Narada Muni. Or did it happen because of the association of Narada Muni, or it happened when Dhruva Maharaj left home? Is it a mercy from a tribulation?
It's mercy from tribulation. It's a natural reaction of someone who has been unkind and they know it.
This is from Amara Mataji. Dhruva Maharaj's intention of getting a bigger kingdom was gradually shifting to getting darshan of Lord Vishnu. So, if one keeps performing devotional service with gradual improvement, then will his intentions get focused on Krishna by power of devotional service? Is this understanding?
It's not automatic. It's not a vending machine, but yes, in due course of time that happens. I think we'll end with the next one. It doesn't matter how many more there are. That's it. We'll just do one.
This is from Sanchari. On the topic of having unflinching faith on the spiritual master, my thoughts turned to conversations and interactions I've had with those who try to explain Srila Prabhupada's more controversial statements from a sociology standpoint. That is, he's a transcendental person, yet was an Indian man, so his views in some way reflect that bias, etc. In a previous conversation, you had stated that such minimization of Srila Prabhupada's position was lethal. Upon reflecting, what I'm understanding is that unknowingly we develop a sense of familiarity with the Acharya and mistake our own interpretations as something arising from knowing such a person. I can see how being overcautious in the relationship with, in my case, the spiritual grandfather can help protect me from developing familiarity. I'm trying to gain clarity on what is the balance in feeling a sense of belonging and acceptance in the relationship with pure devotees who are no longer physically present and not fall into the sense of almost false entitlement and familiarity.
There's a devotee. I'm trying to remember. Shukavak, I think, is his name. Wrote a biography about Bhaktivinoda Thakur's life that was explicitly and deliberately not from the vantage point of he's a pure devotee, and so we see everything through the lens that he's a pure devotee. It was deliberately from the vantage point of someone that sees him as a product of his times, Bhaktivinoda. Because even a transcendentalist is in an environment that is of this world. So they may use expressions and so forth that are their transcendental personality, but also accommodating or reflecting the circumstance of their times. I mean, like, for example, I was just listening to some lecture where Prabhupada was giving examples, and he was using examples that I didn't even know that he knew about. I can't remember exactly. Just like languages of things, of how people describe things. And he just picked up on how people describe things. I'm guessing it wasn't part of his education. It was part of just his experience in the world and being very alert and seeing how people do things and how they name things and so on. So it's being relatable to the world, but being, you know, in contact with the world and expressing in that context. So to say that Prabhupada would sometimes speak in a certain way because he was from a certain period of history, I don't think that's belittling. It's not the essence of who he is. But it's not belittling to say that he would, like, giving anecdotal examples. He would speak sometimes of legs and feet as hands, or something like that. It's just because, or something that I learned that in India, clothing is the word is used as dress, but in America, dress means what a lady wears. A dress or a skirt is what ladies wear. And it's not men don't wear dresses. But it's a cultural thing. So he may use the word dress. Anyway, so it's okay. It doesn't diminish or demean. It's not necessarily demeaning. But, you know, when it does come to controversial things, you know, his use of language may not have been understood by contemporary people because of, you know, the circumstance that he grew up with. You know, his mood is not what, you know, the controversial things that without going into it, what it says. Anyway. So the main thing that you're asking is how to be cautious about becoming familiar with predecessor acharyas and great personalities. You know, it's pretty hard to do that because they're so high. So I think your caution in itself is sufficient. And as you become more familiar with their writings, the respect will grow, not familiarity will grow. Read their writings and try to understand their teaching, and your head will tilt back and your eyes will look as high in the sky as you can go. You won't become familiar. Okay. Prabhupada Ki Jai.